You're listening to the weekly broadcast of World Affairs. It's produced in partnership with KQED. I'm Ray Suarez.
It's all fake news.
You're fake news.
It's phony stuff.
Fake news. Fake news.
Long before it became a favorite catchphrase President Trump uses to dismiss facts he doesn't like, the term fake news was coined by this guy.
I'm Craig Silverman. I'm the media editor for BuzzFeed News. I started using that term in 2014 when I was doing a research project looking at the spread of viral rumors, trying to think about better ways for news organizations to debunk this increasingly viral mis- and disinformation. And I used it to describe content that was false, that was created to deceive, and that was done for an economic motive. And at that point, the number of researchers and journalists and other people who kind of cared about this area of online disinformation, of the manipulation of our media environment, it was a very small group of nerds. I was proud to be a member of it. I still am. But it was very small. And then we get to the end of 2016.
Everything he just said is absolutely false, but I'm not surprised.
Really?
In the first debate...
And it's not just because of the election in the U.S. There was Brexit.
People of Britain have spoken, voting for a British exit, dubbed Brexit.
There was an election in the Philippines where just rampant disinformation on Facebook. We've spent the last 4 years with kind of a global battle where... That term, today it's kind of meaningless because even though it's a globally recognized term, it's in most cases now being used to kind of describe and discredit legitimate reporting, describe and discredit opposition figures and other people. And so we've had a global awakening to this challenge and people stepping up and more people being involved in it than ever before. But the challenge is still massive and global. And there is still so much more to do that I never would have thought we could have 4 years of concerted effort and still end up in a pretty tough place.
Fast forward to August 23rd, Kenosha, Wisconsin.
What the f- did you shoot that man?
Jacob Blake was shot 7 times in the back by a Kenosha police officer.
Video of the shooting, taken by a bystander, sparked outrage.
And there were protests going on for several nights there. And what happened was Facebook became a bit of a rallying point and an organizational place for militias, for people who are, you know, not official members of law enforcement, but who in some cases were heavily armed and who decided that they were going to go and patrol the streets of Kenosha and stop people who they described as rioters and looters. In particular, there was one Facebook page for an organization called the Kenosha Guard. On the morning of the 25th, the Kenosha Guard page created an event for people to bring their weapons and, you know, as they described, kind of protect businesses from looters. But when you looked at the discussion that was going on that event page, it was people talking about going out to murder other people. It was extremely violent. It was people bragging about how many, you know, quote-unquote looters or rioters they were going to shoot that night, talking about using live rounds, talking about using special types of bullets that might hurt people more. One person said, keep them in line if they're protesting, but if they are rioting and destroying things, pew, pew, pew time, referring to gunshots. And he also said, you know, keep the protesters away from you. And we spoke to people who lived in the area, people from other states who came across this event and came across this page and were just looking at the comments and were aghast at what they were seeing. One woman we spoke to, Liz LaHue, a bartender in Illinois, got in an argument with one of the people on this page. And this one guy actually started to threaten her at some point.
So LaHue and other people on social media reported the event to Facebook.
And that page and that event, you know, they break Facebook's rules. Facebook does not allow militias on its platform. Facebook does not allow death threats and violent conversations like that. There were hundreds and hundreds of reports we found from users telling Facebook, hey, there is something wrong here. There is something that you need to fix.
Facebook rejected their complaints. As militia members converged on Kenosha, many used the event page to meet up, organizing in real time. People posted their locations, the types of firearms they were carrying. For example, can someone drop me a location where the heavy, dense fighting area is? Asked one user. Another posted, a caravan full of rioters are headed to Salem and Paddock Lake.
And so over the course of hours, this page was just amping up. The people were just, you know, becoming almost bloodthirsty.
Not down with this.
And of course, as a lot of people know, on the night, there were two people killed and violence broke out in an extremely, you know, aggravated way and dangerous way.
Hey, he just shot them! Hey, dude right here just shot them!
17-year-old Kyle Rittenhouse, the shooter, did not RSVP to the militia events page users complained about. And we don't know if he was inspired by its call to arms. What we do know is that Rittenhouse was seen with other militia members earlier that night.
And then after Kyle Rittenhouse allegedly killed people, the page was actually a place where people went and celebrated it. And even then, some of the Facebook users were reporting it to Facebook, but Facebook still, you know, didn't remove the Kenosha Guard page.
The event page disappeared the next day. At first, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg suggested that his company had removed it.
In fact, it never removed the event page with all these violent comments. It was the creator of the event page from the Kenosha Guard itself who removed it before Facebook got around to it.
I want to share about our investigation.
Zuckerberg spoke directly to his employees about the incident.
You know, the first thing is we designated the shooting as a mass murder and removed the shooter's page and his accounts from Facebook and Instagram. At this point, we haven't yet found any evidence that the shooter was following this Kenosha Guard page or was connected to the event or invited to the event in any way.
There are a lot of people who feel that, you know, even if Kyle Rittenhouse, the alleged shooter, didn't necessarily RSVP to that event, it's that kind of discussion. It's that kind of using the platform to bring people together to take that kind of action that led to the events that night.
Facebook is far from the only big tech company whose platform is used to spread misinformation, hate speech, and extremism. There are gargantuan companies working in this space. Yet the conversation always seems to come around to Facebook. Why are they seen as such a central player? And why are they regarded as having the most dangerous potential by many people who are watching this area closely?
Yeah, it's Facebook is kind of the one that comes up a lot. You're right. And I think part of that is you look at the scale that Facebook operates at. It's a company worth, I think, right now about $750 billion. They don't just have Facebook. They have Instagram and they have WhatsApp, which are massive, massive products in their own rights. More than 2 billion people around the world are using Facebook's products, and they're using them in not just sort of casual ways, but in some cases spending hours a day on these products. And in some cases, WhatsApp is like the default communications service for people in some parts of the world because it uses low bandwidth and low data and it's free. There are countries where, you know, people maybe now are just starting to get their first smartphones. And in a lot of cases, the smartphone you buy is going to come preloaded with Facebook. And so for some people in some countries around the world, Facebook is the internet. That's what everyone they know is on. That's how they communicate, or they're using WhatsApp, another Facebook product. And so that's where we go from just being sort of a popular product to something that becomes the actual communications infrastructure for an entire country. They have a tremendous amount of influence. And so it comes back to them because of that global footprint. And also, of course, because we've seen them implicated in a wide range of hugely problematic and disastrous scenarios. I mean, there is a genocide that has occurred in Myanmar.
The social media site has been used to incite violence against Rohingya refugees living in the country's Rakhine State,
where Facebook, which became really the default digital platform in the country very quickly, Facebook was used to spread the hate that helped inflame it and helped get things out of control there. And we recently reported on a sort of departing memo by a Facebook data scientist, where she talked about discovering, in some cases, heads of state or political organizations in different countries around the world that were manipulating the population using Facebook, using fake accounts to harass the opposition, spreading disinformation. And so even from inside Facebook, they are reckoning with the power that they have and the influence that they have, and realizing that in some cases, as she said, you know, they're not doing enough. And she went so far to even say that she felt she had blood on her hands, because there were times where she felt she was alone in noticing things happening in certain countries, but had to sort of do nothing because she had other responsibilities.
The name of the data scientist who wrote that memo is Sophie Zhang. It's not like a regular resignation letter, not only in the sense that it's massive, 6,600 words long, but also chapter and verse of how a company that has pioneered placelessness has burrowed in to countries all around the world. And some of this stuff is not just dirty tricks, it's not just fake news, but it actually shakes these countries to their foundations. Give us some examples.
Yeah, so, I mean, one example is she found in Azerbaijan, and this is apparently an investigation that is still going on at Facebook, she found that the ruling family and the ruling party there had people who were operating fake accounts at a very large scale. And their job was to make sure that the opposition party there, anything that they posted on Facebook would kind of be have an avalanche of negative comments, of trolling, of harassment. And the same thing with independent media there. Independent media would try to post stories on their Facebook pages, and it would just be inundated with insulting comments and people trolling them. And so, you know, that was an operation that was connected, according to her, to the government, to the ruling party and family. And she said that it took Facebook months and months and months to follow up on her research and actually investigate it. And that is supposedly going on right now. She saw in Ecuador, again, you know, networks of inauthentic interactions like likes and comments, as well as inauthentic accounts. And she saw that, and it was a case where she really couldn't pursue it any further. And then there was civil unrest in that country not long after. She lists country after country. And her central point here is that her job wasn't supposed to be looking for this stuff. She was supposed to be looking for spam, you know, people who were doing this for commercial reasons, but she couldn't help but find it because it was happening so much. And Facebook just didn't give her the support she said she needed to actually pursue these things. And so in the end, she left because she felt like her health was suffering and she couldn't really live with herself, that she was seeing these things and they weren't being followed up on.
She wrote, "I've personally made decisions that affected national presidents without oversight and taken action to enforce against so many prominent politicians globally that I've lost count." It's a remarkable document.
It is. And she is not a senior level data scientist. And that's not to denigrate her skills, which are clearly impressive. The point is that she is a junior employee who spent 3 years at Facebook, who suddenly felt like she was affecting fate of nations. And so why do we talk about Facebook so much? Well, it really can be that significant in terms of its effect.
Governments around the world are struggling to yank power away from Facebook and other social media companies.
Today's hearing is extraordinary.
And in the U.S., House Democrats want to overhaul antitrust laws and force Apple, Amazon, Facebook and Google to break up into smaller companies. All during the era of the rise of Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg would get called to Capitol Hill, and he'd basically say the same thing year after year.
We do not fact-check politicians' speech, and the reason for that is that we believe that in a democracy, it is important that people can see for themselves what politicians are saying.
So if untoward things get said there, it's not our job to police it. It's not our fault if it gets said there. We merely give them the place to go do it. Now, in recent years, he's backed off that some, not entirely, but some. And Facebook now has an enormous arm. Employees who are sifting through content, employees who are taking down pages, who are blocking accounts from suspicious individuals, and still, you can't keep up with it all when one out of every six or seven human beings on the planet has a Facebook account.
there is a huge scale challenge. The amount of comments, videos, everything you can imagine being put on Facebook every day, every minute is just unimaginable. It's something unheard of in human history. We've never had a platform like that with this many people sharing so much personally, professionally, and in so many different areas. But I think there are some key distinctions about this in the sense that, you know, you talked about the number of employees that Facebook has trying to do this kind of content moderation. But the truth is that most of them aren't employees. Anytime this issue is brought up, Facebook always talks about how it now has 35,000 people working in trust and safety, doing content moderation, investigating, you know, inauthentic activity, trying to counter disinformation. But the majority of that number are not employees. They are low-paid contract workers, usually without any kind of benefits, working in the U.S. or in many cases in countries around the world. And that is who the people are, you know, when something gets flagged, who are reviewing a Kenosha Guard page or event. They're the people who are going in when an algorithm surfaces something that may be suspected hate speech or something else, who have to make an evaluation, often very quickly after having received a couple of weeks of training. And so there's a real challenge here where Facebook likes to talk about how many people are doing this work. But number one, we don't really know how many people you need to properly moderate platforms with more than 2 billion people on it. We've never had this problem before as humans. So 35,000 may sound like a lot, but it's probably nowhere near enough. And then the second part is that if it's so important to maintain the integrity of the platform, as they say, by doing content moderation, then why are these people low paid and not having benefits? Why is Facebook itself not training them and bringing them in-house? And I think those are really important problems and challenges, and they speak to how much Facebook has really become committed to this area. Why can't they be employees? Why stop at 35,000? How many do you actually need? And the truth is they don't really know, and nobody really knows. And this is the kind of uncharted territory we're in.
Yeah, I was going to say it's kind of impossible to know. I was reading a story about one of these overseers in just Bangladeshi Facebook. Now you think, you know, you're sitting here in the big, huge United States. Oh, and there's little Bangladesh on the map. And they are looking over Facebook postings in both English and Bengali. And there are six people doing that. And you say, well, okay, you know, they're watching people posting in Bengali. Bangladesh has 161 million people and tens of millions of Facebook accounts. It's really just a job it's hard to conceive of the scale of it.
That's right. And it's a really good example. And there's probably dozens of other countries that are in that same scenario. And you know, Facebook will often say, well, you know, we're doing our best to get people recruited. It's a priority. But at a certain point, you know, when you're a $750 billion company, when you are making record profits, if you can't get the people on the ground to do the job to protect not just your platform, but the actual society there, then maybe you don't get to operate in those countries. And I think that's the regulation point that they want to avoid, where, you know, they don't want it to be dictated where they have to leave a country because they haven't done X, Y, and Z. But this is a scenario that is playing out over and over again. And I think one reason for that is Facebook has always viewed the best way to deal with its scale as an engineering problem. So they prefer to build systems to automatically flag and remove stuff as much as possible. But things like hate speech are really, really difficult engineering problems. There is a lot of nuance contained in just one sentence that it takes a lot of time to train an algorithm to spot. And so I think we're in this horrible moment right now where Facebook is working really hard to try and train up these systems so that it doesn't have to hire a ton of people. But as of right now, you know, it still doesn't have enough people in enough countries around the world to know exactly what's really going on. And so we have this kind of massively influential platform where nobody actually has their arms really around exactly what's going on it at any given time.
Will it take the threat of possibly losing the ability to do business in enough of the world to actually get Facebook to face up to what the problem is, get this under control? Can they do it?
I think the threat of regulation is probably one of the more powerful things. This is such a new challenge that no one's really come up with great frameworks yet. And so the threat of regulation has been forcing Facebook and others to get to the point where they can say, we're taking this very seriously. But, you know, that in and of itself probably hasn't gotten things as far along as possible. So I do think them feeling like they're going to be, you know, kicked out or severely restrained in certain markets is a very deep existential threat for them. It's a business threat. It's also a threat in some ways to the pride of being so big and being everywhere that it's an effective kind of deterrent.
Is really the whole game at this point for big tech to just simply not to be regulated, to maintain, preserve complete freedom of movement?
The regulation question is a very big focus for especially the largest companies. What's been interesting to me over the last, say, just 2 years or so in the US, where companies that have always tried to avoid regulation, they've sort of shifted their approach. And Facebook really typifies this, where at a certain point, Facebook stopped trying to sort of say, like, well, regulation is a bad idea, will harm innovation. They started to say, fine, you know, we are going to be regulated.
I think the real question, as the internet becomes more important in people's lives, is what is the right regulation, not whether there should
be
or not. But
you as a company welcome regulation?
Let's talk about what that should look like. And so I think what we're seeing is them trying to really shape what new laws might look like. And part of the reason for that is, for example, in Western Europe, in the EU, there is a much bigger appetite for regulation. And these companies know that they're getting reined in there, and they know that that could lead to other countries around the world following that example. And so I think they're in a mode right now where they're trying to get ahead of these things, trying to think about what regulation they would like. And in fact, in some ways, what regulation might help entrench, you know, the leadership positions, or some might say monopoly positions, that they have. So it's not necessarily a purely anti-regulation message. It's in some cases a pro-regulation message that is meant to really deliver the kinds of regulation that they would be happy about. But I think we also have to be wary of some of the bad laws that have been passed around the world. You know, in the name of preventing so-called fake news, you have authoritarian governments passing laws that in effect are criminalizing opposition parties, criminalizing independent reporting, and also putting handcuffs on the social networks in ways that is also really dangerous, because, you know, we also want free speech to remain free.
In the US, the content moderating policies Facebook does have been roundly criticized. Republican members of Congress have accused Facebook of liberal bias and censoring conservative Facebook pages. But Craig Silverman's investigations found Facebook has repeatedly given right-wing pages preferential treatment.
And so I wouldn't want to portray this as a simple problem where it's just Facebook needs to do more. We also have to be careful of the things we wish for and watch and see that we don't end up with some really horrible unintended consequences.
As we inch closer to a fraught and contentious election, Facebook is clamping down on misinformation on its platforms. In response to recent criticism, the company announced that it will block any new political ads the week before Election Day and crack down on voter intimidation. It's also banned the conspiracy theory group QAnon from its platforms. But in the era of fake news, that might not be enough.
Here is Trump's message. Tonight, FLOTUS and I tested positive for COVID-19.
And the president this morning is not on oxygen, not having difficulty breathing or walking around.
I just left Walter Reed Medical Center, and it's really something very special.
When it was announced that Donald Trump was found to be infected with the coronavirus and coming down with COVID-19, when I looked in social media, I saw a stunning number of people saying, well, maybe he doesn't really have it. People saying, well, maybe he knows he's had it for a long time and now is getting sick to the point where he finally has to admit it. The lack of belief in any conduit of information was astounding. And that was a kind of a breathtaking reminder to me of how far we had come.
And I think some of this is a larger reflection of the kind of information environment we're in right now, where it feels more conspiratorial than I can ever recall. I think some of it is specific to Trump. There's really never been a president like him in terms of the way he deals with information and the way he elevates conspiratorial thinking and actual conspiracies themselves. But it also does speak to a very conspiratorial and skeptical is usually a good word, but, you know, skeptical to the point of failure, I suppose, environment as well, where, you know, the worst scenario is when people just don't know what to believe. That's actually one of the goals of disinformation, isn't necessarily changing people's minds, but just getting to the point where they're like, well, I mean, this, you know, I saw this in the New York Times, I saw it on CNN, but I also saw this other thing over here on this website, so I'm just not sure what to believe. And that is something to be concerned about. We know that politicians will lie. We know that the government at times has misled people. I don't think we want to go back to believing anything coming from the White House, and we also don't want to get to a place where we can't believe anything and can't actually figure out where to apply our sense of trust.
If there is a successful set of responses to these problems, is it too late? Has the damage already been done? Has the belief in institutions of the news business, of the university, of doctors, has the belief in authority been so eroded by this era that even if we did get our arms around what the challenges are, the audience, the readers, the listeners, the viewers have already been poisoned by the era of fake news?
I think the framing of that is important in the sense that the bigger challenge here are some of the things you talked about. In Western democracies, a loss of faith in the institutions that have always been core to our democracies, whether it's the media or government and industry and all of these things. We see the flaws of them now, perhaps more clearly than ever before, which of course might lead you to trust them less, but they are a reflection of us as human beings. We will not have perfect institutions. And so to me, you know, the commitment has to be to rebuilding them, to making them what we want them to be rather than walking away from them. And I think what we have to have is not just an awareness of disinformation and these kinds of things, but an awareness that democracy takes work. And these institutions and all of these elements of society take work, and we need to be committed to renewing them and rebuilding them. And if we can sort of start to see those larger problems, then I think anything is possible. I remain optimistic about the fact that, you know, if you look at a lot of the data in the U.S., like, yes, it's a much more polarized society, but the vast majority of people are not caught off in conspiracy communities. The vast majority of people are not caught in, you know, hyper-partisan networks where they only get information that is, you know, the extreme versions of their particular point of view. And so I think we shouldn't let ourselves get so far down the road of negativity that we feel like it's time to give up. I think there's a lot that can be, if not reversed, really recalibrated. People are starting to realize the potential effects that these kinds of technologies can have on their lives. And so there is a pushback now that is happening that I think is really important. And people should not feel like, you know, they're powerless. They should realize that actually, when it comes to these for-profit companies, the consumer still has a lot of power. That's something they're going to have to pay attention to.
Craig Silverman is the media editor for BuzzFeed News. Great to talk to you, Craig.
Thanks so much.
You've been listening to World Affairs, produced in partnership with KQED and with funding from First Republic and Chevron. If you missed any part of this program or want to catch up on past episodes, you can download our podcast. Just search for World Affairs, that's one word, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, please leave us a rating. It helps others find our program. This episode was produced by Joanne Jennings, Jared Sport, and Teresa Katsarilis. Julia Kwasnitsa and Temba Daniels provided research assistance. Tatum Sanderback is our digital producer. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. I'm Philip Yun. Thank you for listening.